Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening.
My next guest is David Weiss. David is a community superintendent in Jefferson County Public Schools in Colorado, and he's worked in public education for 19 years. Prior to joining the school leadership team, he served as a principal of Westgate Elementary School for 5 years and as high school assistant principal for 4 years in Douglas County Schools. David has also taught middle school math and science for 8 years. He earned a Bachelor of Science in Elementary Education from Youngstown State University and holds a Master of Business Administration and a specialist license in school leadership from the University of Denver. David is a learner who is passionate about innovation, equity, and opportunity for all students who walk our walkway hallways. David oversees the schools in the Alameda and Jefferson articulation areas in Jeffco Schools. Welcome to the podcast, David.
Thank you. Thanks, Dana. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me here, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, it's also really an honor for me to have just a local leader here from the Denver area. And as I start off every podcast, I'd like to ask you about your trench story and how you managed to crawl out of the trenches.
Yeah, thank you. So I, in preparation for this interview, I actually spent some time listening to your previous podcasts, and I asked you before our interview today how I ended up on your agenda, because going back through the people you've interviewed, you've got some really dynamic guests, people who have written books and people who have their doctorate. And I don't have a doctorate and I haven't written a book. But I appreciate a previous podcast interview that came your way. But in listening to some of the other people talk about their stories of out of the trenches, I was really trying to think about a specific trench story. And I don't know that I really have one trench story, but what it made me realize is that the work that I love to do is in the trenches. Mm-hmm. And something that I thought a lot about as we, you know, listening to your other episodes was, I would say that probably an overall experience I took over a school as an elementary principal that was in some trouble with the state mm-hmm. as far as their performance status, and there were a lot of other things going on in that school. And I would say that on day one, we were in the trenches, and we spent a few years in the trenches there. But the out of the trench story is we did some really powerful work around mission and vision. We did some really incredible community building, got focused on academics, but in the right way. Mm-hmm. And we got that school to be performance for three straight years before I moved into this position. And I'm really proud of that work. And I think that the connection that I made listening to some of your previous interviews is that I don't think I deserve the credit for pulling us out of the trenches. It was, mm-hmm. it was really the work of the people around me. And, I had some incredible teachers and some great leaders in that building who came together. We, as a community, worked so hard together to get close to what we really meant by our mission, which was to lead, love, and learn. Mm-hmm. And it just was really special. And so I still reflect back on that experience frequently as just it's the pinnacle of my career, maybe, or at least up to this point it has been. And, and getting out of the trenches was great. But what I also thought about was, why did I leave there and step into this position mm-hmm. Where I serve primarily Title I schools, and I was a Title I principal, and I serve schools that are in some of my schools, really about half of my schools are in some form of turnaround or priority improvement. And the bottom line is I really like being in the trenches. Mm-hmm. That's where I like to be. I like to work alongside my colleagues, getting dirty, digging into the data, talking about good instruction, really getting focused on how we come together in communities to mm-hmm. really improve things for our students. And I don't really believe that work, happens in a way that is tangible sometimes mm-hmm. Once you're out of the trenches. So I still think obviously the goal is right to help these schools come out of those trenches, but the work that I really enjoy is being there with them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, because like, as you say, you're always going to be supporting schools that are in some form of turnaround or, you know, in the process of, you know, gaining that performance rating. And, you know, as a community superintendent of such a large district, you know, there's going to be schools that you'll need to support. So I really like that answer and how you, you know, you like to be in there and do the hard work with the building leaders and the teachers and looking at the data, kind of seeing how, you know, one school can get to the performance status, but there might be another school the next year that you need to support. So yeah, I really like that. And so tell me a little bit about your position, how long you've been in it. What does a community superintendent do?
Sure. So, you know, it's the name itself is a little tricky because in other school districts, it would probably be called area superintendent or like our quadrant superintendent. So, in Jefferson County, as you know, Dana, being local, we're a gigantic school district. We have 162 schools. So we have a superintendent, we have a deputy superintendent, but we also have 12 community superintendents. So, and each of us serves a different grouping of schools. Some of our community superintendents are very specific with secondary, so they work with middle and high schools. Some of our community supers are elementary, so they work with elementary schools. I work with both elementary and secondary schools. And some of that comes from my background, which you talked about at the beginning. I was a middle school teacher and then a high school AP and then an elementary principal. So I love that I've had that experience in the entire really pre-K through 12 system. But it also has, I think, uniquely suited me to support in the areas that I do. So I have two articulation areas. So basically I serve the elementaries and then the junior, senior high schools that are in one articulation together. So I serve all of the families in the Alameda and the Jefferson areas. And if you know Jeffco in Jefferson County, the more eastern part of the district serves more of a Title I higher free and reduced lunch population, which is the schools that I serve. And that's just like the school that I was a principal of as well. So as far as what my work entails, my job is to create the conditions for my principals to succeed and better outcomes for our students. And whether that means being there to process through a conversation with them, supporting them in a tough conversation with somebody who's not performing well, you know, digging through the data with them as they prepare for their PLC conversations or their DDI conversations with their staff, helping them with hiring, budget decisions, financial decisions. You know, the angry parent that has had enough of the principal and then needs to mm-hmm. go higher up in the organization, that comes to me as well. And so, you know, on any given day, you know, some days my job is really just principal coach and and leadership coach. And on some days it's more operational and a little more, you know, dealing with some of those management items. And part of what I love about it is it could change, you know, right in the middle of the day. You know, we could be engaged in some really great instructional conversations and then somebody starts acting a little funny somewhere and, you know, I have to go respond to another school. So I typically am in about three schools a day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, while I'm considered to be a air quote central office employee, 80% of my week is in schools. So, and typically, like I said, about three a day, you know, and depending on the work we're doing, sometimes we walk through classrooms together, sometimes we you know, we'll just evaluate the school's performance management improvement plan. So it's a lot of fun, you know. And then of course I've got the responsibility of supporting our district mission and vision and ensuring that takes place too out in our schools.
Yeah, and I really like the fact that you are walking around in the hallways with the principal, or sometimes do you just kind of visit the classrooms on your own as well, or is it usually with one of the members of the admin team?
Usually I'm with people from the school. I don't typically just walk in on my own, only because, you know, I'm in just about every school every week, but that one visit per week doesn't necessarily get me on a first name basis with all the teachers and students. So I don't think it's fair to our teachers or students to just surprise them. So I usually am with one of the administrators or an instructional coach from time to time, in our turnaround schools, we do visits with CDE as well, our State Department of Education, to evaluate their improvement plans. So sometimes we'll be together with them as well.
Tell me a little bit about just that shift from you're working at Douglas County Schools as an assistant principal, and you know it's a high performing, you know, high social economic status district, and then you went to be a Title I principal, and kind of what you learned from that experience.
Well, I mean, I was a teacher in Title I schools in DPS before being in Douglas County. And I think really my experience in Douglas County is what led me back to Title I schools.
Yeah.
All due respect to Douglas County, working in high affluent schools with high affluent communities, just there was always something missing for me.
Yeah.
You know, and not, and I enjoyed my work when I was in Doug Co. There was some great work that I was able to do with some students and families and teachers, and I'm proud of it. But really, the whole time, I just felt like there was a piece of what I had when I was in the classroom that I was missing, and some of that was really working with our most impacted students, some of whom are the most brilliant kids walking on the planet, and we need the opportunity to lift them up and help them grow. And so the shift wasn't that hard for me necessarily because I really had that Title I experience as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest shift I would say is, you know, it took a few months to just kind of remember how much poverty really impacts a family and a student,
mm-hmm.
You know, and because it's easy to lose sight of that when you're working in high affluent communities. But you know, really poverty has such a significant impact on students and families. And so, and, you know, as a result that the effect on their educational experience is impacted. And so, you know, as a principal, one of my objectives in my current role too, is, you know, schools as community hubs is something that's a real priority for me. At Westgate, where I was the principal, we started a community hub where we were providing food, clothing, connections to things like, you know, taxes or food stamps or bus passes.
Mm-hmm.
And really we were connected with some local churches, a couple of great local leaders in Lakewood and then in our church communities who really helped me support my kids. And it just, you know, it was actually probably good that I stepped away for a little while to come back because it just, my eyes were just that much more open. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that was that there were a lot of conversations with staff and with the district to help make sure our kids had what they needed. And, you know, working in Title I schools, that's part of our job is it's not just academics and,
mm-hmm.
You know, so we got to really take care of our kids and our families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I kind of have that same experience too, kind of working in at both ends of the spectrum and, you know, making sure, you know, that we have like, for example, those winter coat collections, right? Or, you know, when we need to give out, like have a food bank at the school, right? On Thursdays in a Title I school I've worked in. Just those certain types of things where parents know they could come in and get those things that they need, right? And that we're able to connect students with just the outside resources that, you know, they might not know about. So yeah, I could, I'm similar with you in the fact that, you know, I have that passion to help. You know, help connect families, help just give them resources. And you talked to me a little bit in the pre-chat about just that progress monitoring. That first year you were working and, you know, the year you didn't get to the improvement goals. So did it take a little while to get kind of to that performance status?
Yeah, well, we got there in 2 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the first year, like any, well, it depends. I mean, but I'd like to believe that most good leaders are going to spend a lot of their first year mm-hmm. sort of figuring out the system that they've taken over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a place for leaders who come in and just take over and start directing the work. But I like to believe that I spent a lot of that time in that first year figuring out the building, the culture, what we needed to do, and really getting our head wrapped around
mm-hmm.
A direction, because when you're in some form of turnaround, it's really easy to think everything is important all the time.
Yeah.
You know, our math scores are important, our reading scores are important, our students on IEPs are not performing well, our students of color are not performing well, and while those things all may be true, if you're really going to improve a school, you can't necessarily try to focus on every single thing that is a that is a problem or is a challenge or is performing below where it should be. The goal obviously is to get to all of those things, but ultimately mm-hmm. you've got to narrow the focus and you've got to get really dialed into how to be good at those things. And so, you know, in Colorado, we use something called a unified improvement plan in every school. And that was the first step for us, was to get really focused and connected to an improvement plan that made sense to our staff, that they could speak to. They mm-hmm. knew what the goals were. They knew what the action steps were that we were going to take to get there. And then we monitored that constantly along the way with, you know, PLC meetings or DDI meetings. You know, we were constantly checking to see, you know, are we getting to that goal, whether it was, you know, achieving to 65% by the end of the year, you know, in the middle of October, we're checking that. Are we mm-hmm. getting there? And if not, what are we adjusting? What are we changing? What are we doing? And then really, I would say in that second and third year is when we came together as a community and we decided on a mission. Mm-hmm. It took us 6 months to write it, but the mission was to lead, love, and learn. And I bucked all the Jim Collins of the world and all the other mm-hmm. leadership writers. And I just said, you know what? I don't want a vision statement. I don't want a tagline. I don't want a run-on sentence. So that was it. Those were our three words, lead, love, learn. And every conversation that we had, whether it was in our instructional leadership team or our collaborative decision-making team or our PTA and accountability meeting, at any time an idea came up, the first question to ask was, does it fit our mission? Because mm-hmm. if it doesn't fit our mission, we don't do it. And, you know, and when we felt like we weren't improving, you know, that's our mission is to learn. And that means we need to take a step back. And if we're making mistakes, we need to fix them versus just continuing to plow through the curriculum because we have a pacing guide mm-hmm. or, you know, just because we know we need to get to this place by this time of the year, that's not relevant if we're not improving outcomes for kids. Mm-hmm. And so, I would say the other big step that we took is we made it a part of our norm to discuss the undiscussables. Yeah. You know, we discussed the fact that we have Black and brown boys in our school who are not being served, and that's mm-hmm. not okay. You know, there's nothing wrong with our Black and brown boys. If there's anything wrong with them, it's us, the educators, yeah. we're the problem. And so we had to have really honest conversations with each other and with ourselves about the undiscussables or what had previously been undiscussables. And so once we got real about our mission, I would say that's when things really took off. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to performance in 2 years, we crushed performance the next 2 years. And I really believe that getting focused on a mission, holding ourselves accountable to it, and really just, I mean, honestly, it's so hard to describe in words how our community came together. Mm-hmm. You could ask people in the neighborhood, what was the mission at Westgate? And they would tell you it was lead, love, learn. Everybody knows, mm-hmm. you know, we were on social media. I used to tell my teachers, drop the curtain. You're doing great things. Show teachers, show the people what you're doing, put it on Twitter, put it on Facebook. And so it was just, you know, and then we got to that place where we could just really celebrate and be excited. Mm-hmm. And one might say we were a bit out of the trenches. And I'm not going to lie, at the beginning of that fifth year, I knew I needed to find another trench to get into.
Yeah.
To be honest, that was, I had a great assistant principal. It was an opportunity to groom her and hand it off to her. And I knew, and then this opportunity came up to work with some of our most highly impacted schools and, to work in some schools that are in turnaround. And so there you go. That's the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I really liked how, like, you revisited that with your staff, right, at the PLC meetings, the UIP goals. Cause, you know, kind of thinking back to when I taught, you know, we'd be aware of the UIP and, you know, what things needed to change and kind of looking at how the data affected, you know, how our kids were doing, but it wasn't something that was truly in all the work everybody did. And it wasn't something that always came back down from the principal, right? And I think how you're describing it, you made it part of those, I would say, weekly discussions, right? With the teachers and their team meetings, they would always go back to see, like, check, you know, those kind of self-checks to see how everything was going, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, and I probably should have mentioned this, but I teach instructional leadership and data literacy in the Regis mm-hmm. University Administrative Program. And I mean, that's one of the first things that I talk about with our students there who are up and coming mm-hmm. School leaders is alignment is critical. And if you say in your UIP that our goal is 65% of kids are going to grow to this, you know, grow to this point in literacy, then if that's our school goal, then that better be your goal in third grade. That better be your goal in fourth grade. That better be your goal in first grade. Mm-hmm. Because if that's the goal in everybody's classroom, the likelihood of us reaching that goal as a school is significantly greater, you know? And so everybody needs to know the goals. They need to be able to articulate it. They need to be able to evaluate whether or not they're achieving to it, where they are in the continuum of that. That's really critical to really improving any school, I'm sure. You know, even schools that are in performance, that's something they need to be thinking about. Is that alignment clear? And are we revisiting it and hitting it constantly? And are we adjusting when we're not getting there?
Mm-hmm. This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great point. So how do you make sure the schools that you're currently supporting have everything they need to get across that finish line at any given time? I mean, we've had a little bit of disruption. We didn't have any standardized testing to kind of, you know, gauge the plan type of the schools in 2020. And we had, you know, abbreviated standardized testing this past spring, but like just in the other points of data that you look like. So how are you kind of making sure that that's, you know, that you're kind of helping cross those T's and dot those I's?
You know, I think this year we still have some interim measure assessments that we use in our district, but we also did some work with like around culture, because with the pandemic, you know, I mean, most of my time in this position, we've been in a pandemic.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we really took some time to develop some sort of self-assessment tools, I guess, as a school. Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about how important culture is going to be, you know, during the pandemic and really after the pandemic as well. And so we did some surveys around culture that we ran weekly or biweekly in schools, where we were evaluating whether or not staff had what they need, whether or not they were feeling supported. We also ran surveys with students. Did they feel like they got what they needed out of school? Did they feel safe and comfortable at school? Because we've been in, as you know, we've been in school in person most of the year here in Jeffco. And so we've had both remote and in-person options, but we've been in person for all but 4 weeks of this whole school year. So, so we were trying to evaluate those things. We also had some assessments that we created at different grade levels, where we were evaluating progress in math and literacy. And then we still had, we used a progress monitoring tool for literacy. So we've got read plans here in Colorado. So we were still collecting some pretty decent data, I would say. The validity of the data is questionable, I think, in the middle of the pandemic, you know, especially with some students taking some of these assessments at home.
Yeah.
You know, and so I really think it's going to be so important in the fall. I don't want to start the year with assessments. I really have been really encouraging my principals to not start the year with assessments. But within the first few weeks, we do need to start evaluating where kids are at.
Yeah.
Because I think, and this may be part of my parting message with your last question that you'll ask me, but I really think that we have a lot of kids that are going to be okay and just fine.
Yeah.
But we also have some kids that are not. And right now we don't really know who they are.
Yeah.
And I don't want people to make assumptions about what they think they know. I hate how the media keeps talking about learning loss and all the things that we've lost with this pandemic. I really wish we would shift that conversation to what have we gained, because there is so much that our kids have learned, the resilience they've developed. And honestly, there's going to be some kids who are just fine. They really are. And there's going to be some kids who did lose learning. I mean, let's be honest. I know we're not the only school district in the country that's had students who have just like kind of disappeared too. You know, I think we've all had that, right? We've all had a couple kids here and there who have just, you know, we couldn't go out and do home visits or because of the pandemic. And, you know, those students might be returning to us and having missed an entire year of school.
Yeah.
I really am pushing my leaders to think about not making assumptions about what we think kids need. Yeah. I really want to see use data in September to be evaluating who needs what and why, and really be thoughtful about the interventions that we put in place for kids and not force students in interventions they don't need. I've heard a lot of people talk about increasing social emotional supports for students at schools. Well, do we have a lot of really good data that says that's important? probably so for secondary kids. I think our high school kids are really impacted by this pandemic, but I think a lot of our elementary kids, and this is perceptual data that I'm using, but I would say that I think a lot of our elementary kids are actually pretty okay. You know, I have two elementary children of my own, and you know, wearing a mask to go to school, that was no big deal for them. They got to go be around their friends and have recess and lunch. Like they, and sure, it was a different year for them, but I don't, my kids don't need social emotional supports, and we're a very privileged family. So to be fair, I understand that, but I also, I really am thinking as we, you know, this pandemic in itself could even be defined as a trench, right, Dana? Like as you think about trenches, this pandemic could be defined as a trench. And as we climb out of it, it's going to be so critical that we are careful and thoughtful about who and what we put in place for kids. And we have got to be honoring of what they have learned, because our kids have learned a lot. And so have our adults, quite frankly, but our kids have learned a lot.
Yeah. I like all those points that you're talking about. Like myself, a child in fifth grade in kindergarten this past year, and you know, it wasn't really much different for them. And I think that's a lot because they didn't really have to quarantine much. And they also, their schools were open more, you know, I know at least in Douglas County, you know, a lot of the high schoolers, they had to, they were in and out of quarantine so much, right? And a lot of them lost a lot of that social connection. And we had our buildings closed like probably 2.5 months, right? In the middle of winter, right? So I think like you're saying, those older kids that are missing those connections, you know, they gained it a lot at the end of the school year, but I think just kind of working on those needs. And, you know, like you said, a lot of those kids, especially at the secondary level, might have intermittently just logged into classes, right? And it'll be interesting to kind of see where they're at, but definitely focus on that culture. And I'm glad, you know, you were working on that this past year or so with your principals and just seeing, you know, how the school can, you know, build a welcoming culture for students. So it's kind of talking about that post-pandemic piece. What innovations or strategies are you looking forward to working with in JEFCO in the upcoming school year?
Well, I maybe not so directly myself working with this, but, you know, you even brought up just now some of our high school kids intermittently logging in. We found that a lot of kids were working during the pandemic. They just took jobs, some of the high school kids, and they were, it's interesting, but some of them were still able to participate pretty well with school, even though they were working and balancing some different priorities. And so in JEFCO, we've started a remote learning program. We already had an online high school that was entirely asynchronous. We're sort of building like a secondary model. When I say secondary, I don't mean like middle and high school. I mean an additional model for K through 12 remote learning, where there's going to be, you know, a mix of synchronous and asynchronous learning. It's going to be really housed, like led as a school. And so it's kind of exciting to think about that, because we do have, you know, again, not making assumptions about kids. There are some kids who are really good at remote learning. There really are. And there are some kids who thrive in remote learning. And we have an obligation to those students because we didn't know before that they would thrive in that. And we were forced into a reality where they had to, and some of them really just did great. You know, we also have kids like my own children who don't like remote learning and are not good at it, you know, and we have an obligation to those students too. But I think the two things that I really hope we don't forget is one, the pandemic forced us into some equity conversations that were really critical. A lot of people didn't realize how much some of our families or some of our students, how much they didn't have or how little access they had to things like internet or technology or even food. I mean, we were serving food in some of our locations, and, you know, some of our elementary schools have 50, 60 families come pick up lunch every day because it was helping them. And so I'm hoping that coming out of this pandemic, that we don't forget the equity conversations we were forced to have because of the pandemic, because honestly, there are conversations that should have been happening before the pandemic started. As disappointed as I can be in the pre-pandemic experience that we had not getting into these equity conversations enough, I think people like to talk about equity, but whether or not people talk about it and do it, those are two different things.
Yeah.
But I really hope that coming out of this pandemic, that we don't forget the equity conversations that we were forced to have, and we need to continue to have after the pandemic. And the second thing is, our teachers kicked ass in this pandemic. And honestly, the way that they responded, I think needs to be a sign to the world that, you know, I think testing and data is important, is an important part of our work, but I don't think it's the most critical aspect of our work. And I don't think that accountability continues to improve our schools. You know, and I think that's, I think accountability is a part of that work. I'm not saying that it's not, but our teachers were forced to innovate. They were forced to show up in remote. They were forced to try and engage students that didn't have the access to the technology or didn't want to engage online. And honestly, I think some of our teachers learned some really cool things along the way. And if we're being honest, I think overall, I would hope that when we come out of this pandemic, that we don't just rush back to the way it was before. I really hope, and you know, I think a lot of people are saying this, so I'm not like unique and making this statement, but I think that, you know, our educators are special and they've done some really special things. And I know some of them miss like the old way. But at the same time, I hope when they get back into their classrooms and they're in person, they're still finding a way to engage in technology or to allow a student to participate in a blog post. I had somebody share an experience with me about how they had an ASD student in their classroom, an elementary classroom, and the student is more or less nonverbal and, or at least is choosing to be nonverbal at school. And so the pandemic started, they got their classroom up and running, and then they started like an online blog. And this student would engage in writing in the online blog almost daily and loved to express his thinking in that blog, you know? And like, what can we learn from that? Like that student doesn't engage at school, probably because who knows? I mean, I can make a lot of assumptions, but whether it's fear or anxiety or his autism that's causing that, he just doesn't feel safe and comfortable to share at school. But if you put a computer in front of him and you give him the opportunity to express himself in writing in a blog, he'll go all day. And so like, what can we learn from that? You know, there are students like that all across our country, all across our, around our world. And how we, coming out of this pandemic, we can't forget, you know, those types of experiences that can inform our practice and help us be better at what we do in the future.
Yeah, I really like that point. And, you know, like you're talking about also the teachers, whether or not like they've been regarded as heroes in the pandemic, you know, we can't pay them for what they're really worth. Something you mentioned in the pre-chat, how do we harness the energy that they've created, right, and share with the rest of the world? A lot of teachers, I think, and that's a discussion I had on an episode I recently published, is that a lot of teachers have that fear that they're not good enough or, you know, they're not doing enough, right, even though they've been over backwards this year. So I think, you know, also just putting more emphasis on appreciating what the staff members are doing is important.
Yep. Absolutely.
So how do we lift up some young leaders and engage them in part of the system?
You mean like teacher leaders or young
teacher? Yeah, teacher leaders. So a lot of the time, you know, like kind of tying into that last statement I made about teachers that feel like, you know, maybe they're not good enough or, you know, they're afraid to share some of their expertise. A lot of these teacher leaders remain undiscovered, right? Undiscovered talent. You know, they might be in a school for 5 to 10 years and, you know, kind of staying in, you know, don't venture into that like department chair or teacher leader position. So how do we create more opportunities for them to share out their expertise?
Well, I learned a hard lesson probably early in my principalship in that not everybody wants to be a leader and that's okay. And so I think for one, we need to be careful about, you know, I think you and I talked about this on the phone, but I do really want to be able to lift up some of these teachers who have like just kicked butt during the pandemic and give them opportunities to share the innovative practices that they've created and you know, embraced. But I also want to make sure leaders know that you gotta make sure you ask those teachers as well. So I would just, that would one be one sort of like, a precaution just to think about, you know, whether or not a teacher wants to be a leader, because not all of them do. And I tried to really kind of push somebody into leadership early in my principalship, and it sort of backfired. And so that's one cautionary tale I'd put out there. That being said, I think we have some teachers that have done some really innovative things. And for all the grief that people give millennials, you know, I think we have some millennial teachers who were really ready for this pandemic more so than others, because they've grown up in a technological world. They just have. They've just grown up where technology has always been ever present. It's been in their hands their whole lives. And so, you know, and in education, we love to empower sometimes our most veteran teachers. And all due respect to our most veteran teachers, because I'm getting to that point in my career where I'm pretty veteran too.
Yeah.
I think we need to really respect and understand that some of our young teachers are doing some pretty cool things, and kids are connecting with them in really interesting ways. And, you know, whether it's a matter of bringing them onto an instructional leadership team, or doing instructional rounds within your building where you can, you know, bring people around to see those practices that are happening in those classrooms. And again, to be fair, I've seen some very veteran teachers do some really innovative things too. Mm-hmm, so, you know, I'm not trying to say it's only the young teachers that are doing that, but, you know, there are different ways to allow people to lead. And you got to allow people to lead the way they want to lead. And so if they want to be on the ILT, great, bring them on the ILT. If they want to be a part of your improvement planning process, bring them into that. And if they don't, and they're just willing to share their practice through observation, then let's take some people to their classroom. Let's see what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, let them share in a staff meeting, let them share some of their practices if they're comfortable doing that. And so, you know, those are just some ideas that I've been thinking about too, because, you know, it's just been neat to watch. You know, we've seen some pretty cool things from teachers, and just, you know, some of them have gotten really creative.
Yeah, I think this has definitely been a time where, you know, if you had something to share, you know, a lot of people shared what tools they were using and kind of those innovative practices. But yeah, I agree. You know, the teacher leadership could just be as simple as having, you know, people tour your classroom and, you know, do a discussion about kind of things that you have displayed in your classroom and how you're, you know, using some of your, let's say, artifacts of the student work and those type of things. So, well, out of everything we talked about today on the podcast, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
I think, I know when this gets published, it might be right around the beginning of school, I'm thinking. And so I would say that if there's something that people would remember, and I really hope we all think about this, is I want us to be really careful and thoughtful about what assumptions we make about students coming back in August and September. Mm-hmm. They're not broken. Our kids are not broken. Our kids, they gained a lot of learning, regardless of what you think. And honestly, we need to be very careful and methodical about how we determine what kids really need in the fall. And I would say to our leaders, we need to be really careful and thoughtful to evaluate what our teachers need as well. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we have some teachers who are going to be just fine too. And we have some teachers who are really impacted by this pandemic. Honestly, I think adults were impacted more than kids were. So I think as school systems, we have an obligation to figure out what our adults need. And as school leaders, we need to make sure also that we figure out what our kids need. Let's figure out what they need, but let's not decide for them what they need. You know, let's not have a savior complex about what we think our kids need. Let's take time. Let's bring them back. Let's build culture. Let's build community. Let's check on everybody. Let's make sure they're okay. You know, and then let's collect some data and let's see, what do they really need? Because I don't want us to start giving interventions of all sorts to kids that don't need them. And for us to make assumptions about social emotional needs or academic needs of students. I think a lot of kids have weathered this pandemic relatively well. And we just need to be thoughtful and careful. And let's make sure that we're making informed decisions about how we're supporting kids and adults in our system.
Yeah, very well said. You know, focus those energies in the right place. And try to, you know, identify those people who need it the most. Definitely put the adults in that bucket as well, because there are a lot of staff members who you know, been pretty quiet, and definitely want to show our support as we go into the next school year. Well, where can people connect with you and find you online?
The easiest place is on Twitter. I haven't actually been as active on Twitter, I would say, in the last probably few months, partly because of the work. I've just been really busy at work. Mm-hmm. I've been in the trenches. I'm at Teacher Dave on Twitter. And I'll always be at Teacher Dave. I think from the beginning of my career to the end of it, I'm a teacher first. And so I'm at Teacher Dave on Twitter. That's probably the easiest way to reach me.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Thank you so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast today.
Yep. Thank you very much, Dana. I really appreciate the opportunity to hang out with you for a little bit.
Check out the show notes on danagoodyear.com to learn more about this guest and links to their social media. Please subscribe, share, rate, and review wherever you download this podcast. Tell your friends and colleagues about it, and if this episode resonates especially with you, be sure to share it out on social media and tag me at Out of Trenches PC.